Hey everybody, just a quick word before we get started with this week's episode. We've got two pairs of tickets to give away to the Duncan Trussell show coming up on November 20th at Chop Suey, 9 p.m. at Laugh Hole. Yes, that's right, Laugh Hole, November 20th with Duncan Trussell, who you may know from multiple appearances on the Joe Rogan show and also his own show, the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. So email me, aaron@air-raid.net. The fifth and sixth email will get two tickets to go see Duncan Trussell. November 20th, Chop Suey, $10 in advance. Well, hello and welcome, everyone.
Oh, hey.
Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
This is episode 121.
That's cool if you want to be sober and vomit.
What is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series.
You sound insane. Do you realize that?
I am your host, Aaron Roden.
Can you get an STD from a polar bear?
Yeah. And this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. And, wow, we have got a great show planned for you today, guys. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with listener Steven from over in New York. And he's going to relay what it was like going through Hurricane Sandy and what it's like right now. Over there, yeah, boy, I'm looking forward to talking with him. After that, we've got a great, pretty serious discussion with author Charles R. Cross, and I was a little bit, I always get nervous having like a professional writer or a professional, journalist on the show. Like I was a bit nervous when we had Mark Baumgarten on, or Baumgarten, because, you know, these guys are intellectuals, man. And, you know, I wouldn't go as far as calling my show or myself an intellectual. I'm not going to call myself stupid now, but I don't do a lot of research before somebody comes over. But for somebody like that, God dang it, man, maybe it's a good idea to do some research, right? Make sure you have some of the facts straight. He had to correct me quite a few times on some of the facts. But it's an interesting conversation, and we get an interesting take on a professional author's experience here in the music scene in Seattle, of course. With what's going on right now with writing, journalism, and newspapers, and people losing their jobs, man. Jabs. It's all about the jabs. Anyway, it's a good discussion. I hope you guys stick around for it. Let's see, what else has been going on? God, a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff been going on for the Air Raid Podcast. We've got some good news, some great news coming up. I don't know if I should talk. Maybe I should cut that out. I don't know if I'm supposed to really talk about it yet. But we are kind of in talks with Cairo, with the radio station, to possibly, and I'm saying that, you know, with air quotes here in podcast land, that we may have a chance of making this show a weekend show on the actual terrestrial radio. Now, what they would do, they would take, you know, pieces from the existing show, the existing podcast, and stitch them together and put them out for the masses, if you will, on the weekends. And this is exciting for me. This is really exciting for me. I was contacted a couple, earlier this week by Cairo and asked to come in and meet with the heads, you know, and talk about stuff. So, you know, even if something doesn't happen like that, I mean, that's pretty cool. It made me feel pretty good about what we are doing here and the time and effort we put in to this program. Of course, you know, that means, you know, nothing's really going to change with the show. But we really appreciate all of you guys listening. And it's really great, you know, it's a great feeling to have that acknowledgement, right? So, you know, thank you in advance, for everything you do for us. And remember, you can go to air-ray.net and make a donation to the show. You can also buy some of our merchandise from there on our fancy new merch tab. And we have this donate button. And, you know, we say this in the pre-roll sometimes, that, you know, it really does help having those donations. We do need some new equipment, we need your help with that, because it does take money to put this show out each week. It takes a lot of money to keep the website up and running and up to date, and it also equipment, very expensive, guys, very expensive stuff. If you can help out, you know, maybe $5 here, $10 there, maybe $100,000 there, you know, whatever. Just go and press the donate tab or donate button, and donate a couple bucks to the show, because it does actually go to a good place. It doesn't go to booze and cigarettes. It goes to equipment and paying the web guy. So with that said, let's do this, shall we? Let's call up our friend listener Steven. I think you say it's Kopfer. Kopfer, yeah. Let's call this guy up, shall we?
Hey, Aaron.
Good morning, Steven.
Hey, how are you, man?
Good.
Really early. Good morning.
It is quite early. And when you wrote me in the email saying that you wanted to break the record for the earliest Air Raid podcast interview, I did remember that we did do Bob Saget, I think at
right.
around the same time. So,
oh man, oh well.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That's all right, man. I listened to that one on the plane. I forget. I half of your shows I listen to when I'm traveling on the plane.
Well, I'm glad you just listened to them.
It's all good.
You know, that's what I'm going for, I guess. Okay, so Steven, thank you. Thanks for letting me give you a call here. Happy anniversary, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Is today today's your anniversary?
Yep, 5 years.
5 years.
11 years together, 5 years married.
You know, we did kind of the same thing. We've been together for, let's see. I believe it's coming up on 6 years now, but we were together a lot longer than we had been married.
Yeah, I'm not sure the case in your situation, but for us, we were both sort of older. I mean, you know, with established lives and stuff, and we kind of knew what we wanted. And I think when people get married younger, not always, of course, but sometimes. Just not sure what you want, and I don't know. It just seems so natural. Maybe just because I found the right person, anyway. So
well, there you go.
There we go.
Yeah, congratulations, man.
Well, thanks.
So you live over what area of New York do you live in, Stephen?
I live in Queens. It's one of the five boroughs.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, the part of the Queens I live in is called Astoria.
Oh, where, yeah.
Yeah, I actually live about half a block from the East River.
Wow.
So from the end of my street, you can look across and see Harlem. you know, that's sort of as to give people an idea of what part of Manhattan we're near. So,
right, right.
So it would be like a parallel to upper Manhattan.
So when you guys got the news that this storm was going to be bearing down on you guys, did you take the warning seriously? Did you, like, you know, personally,
yeah,
say, okay, well, this is just, you know, the media is blowing it out of proportion like they do with a lot of stuff, you know, we're going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine.
Well, I'm not going to lie, and at first we definitely did, but then in fact, you know, we had, you know, when everybody was bulking up with water and supplies and things, we still had everything left over from Hurricane Irene, which was like sort of a bust, you know, a lot of warnings. I mean, it wasn't a bust for other parts of the state, but for New York City, it was really not much. So we still had, you know, water and everything from that time. So we didn't really need to go out and do much in terms of buying stuff to hunker down, but we did as the storm got closer and we realized, you know, even the media, even the local media was saying, look, guys, we know that you didn't take it seriously last time. And, you know, it's like, even when the media is pointing out, like, okay, this is even going to be worse than we're expecting. Please, please take us seriously. Then we took it seriously.
Right, right.
I think one of the misleading things is sort of this psychological, when people think storm, they think rain, you know, and the storm brought almost no rain. So it was really just wind and tidal surge. So it did sneak up on people, you know, when there's like rain and thunder and lightning and sort
yeah,
of
cause it's physical. You can actually see it building up, right?
Yeah, exactly. This one, you didn't really see. I mean, we went down to the end of our street at about 3 o'clock, you know, and there's a 14-foot seawall at the end of our street.
Mm-hmm.
And the water was rough and everything, but still like sort of normal levels. And then we went down and they said, you know, 7 o'clock was sort of going to be, 7 p.m. was going to be the real tipping point because that's when the high tide came in.
Uh-huh.
At 6:30, the water was at the top of the seawall, like ready to go over the top. Right?
And that's how tall was that, you said?
That's about 14 feet.
14
you know?
Feet. So at that point, when you see the water that high, what's going through your head at that time?
Well,
are you getting at least a little bit freaked out now?
Yeah, we're getting nervous. And then the wind was at that point really kicking up. I mean, where I live, I'm on a hill, actually, even
uh-huh.
though I'm right next to the water. So the city is divided into zones.
Right.
Zone A, Zone B, Zone C, like flood zones.
Okay.
And even though we're like half a block away from the water, we're just at the very outer edge of a Zone C, right, because we're so high up.
Okay.
But we were obviously still worried. I mean, a lot of our friends and family aren't in Zone C's, you know, my uncle lives in a part of the city that's Zone A called Throgs Neck, which is sort of right under the Throgs Neck Bridge, and he's a lifelong sailor, maritime community, and, you know, so they live in Zone A, but thankfully, he even did okay. His boat miraculously was spared. You know, at the dock mm-hmm. where all the boats are, like all the other boats ended up like, sort of in a big pile, you know, against the rocks.
Yeah. I saw pictures like that. I don't know if it was from your neighborhood, but or your friend's neighborhood, but man, yeah, that's an amazing sight too to see, like, just these huge boats just kind of stacked on top of each other. It's so weird.
It's bizarre, and what's really bizarre for me and for a lot of is that the way that the city was hit was sort of, you know, the way nature is. It was very whimsical. So, like, I never lost power.
Mm-hmm.
I never lost internet or telephone or anything. And even my street got very little damage, wind damage.
Yeah, and I saw some of the pictures that you took, and it was mostly of just, like, these giant trees that were uprooted and you know laying all over the place. But sorry
yeah,
for interjecting.
That's about the
there,
worst of our neighborhood. But then if you literally go a few miles in another direction, you'll have, you know, in Queens, we got hit really badly. You know, you have other parts of Queens that look like a bomb went off.
Right,
know?
Right.
And it's really, really kind of surreal to go along with your life in sort of semi-normalcy while you know other parts of the city really right. living like it was Katrina. You know?
Yeah, yeah, and just totally devastated. So have you been able to kind of walk around some of the harder hit areas then, or?
Being sort of like a typical New York City person, I don't own a car.
Right.
Right. So,
right. And we tried to, I'll say this. We tried to set this up for the other night. Right.
Right.
And you didn't even know, I think we were emailing back and forth. What time was it your time? Like maybe 12?
Yeah, it was just in the late morning, early afternoon, and I was going to walk to
You were going to walk
Manhattan.
To your gym, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because my gym, you know, basically sort of the guideline was everything below 38th Street in Manhattan, all of lower Manhattan was in the dark.
Right, right.
And for people listening that maybe have some idea of Manhattan geography, the East River had flooded all the way up to Second Avenue, which means it went over, you know, several avenues worth of land, you know, which is Second Avenue is, that's a long way in. And then on the west side of Manhattan, the water from the Hudson went all the way up to like past 10th Avenue, which, I mean, it's kind of funny in this real weird kind of way because Manhattan, since it's, purchase, you know, in the colonial days, has expanded in size due to landfill and more landfill and more landfill. That's one of the reasons, actually, why the currents are so bad in New York City or in the surrounding waters, because the waterways have become more narrow because Manhattan has kept expanding in size.
Right, right. So, yeah.
So it's almost like the nature brought back the original boundaries, you know, went back to its original, like, place where it should be, the water. But so my
showed those rich folks who's boss.
Yeah, well, you know that's a whole separate issue is how people are being treated here. You know, rich versus poor.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because we're running short on time here. But I did want to ask you, like, being or living there and living through this, even though you know you may not be. You're one of the lucky ones. You and your wife are definitely one of the lucky ones here.
Yeah, that's true.
But do you see a discrepancy in how people are being treated and what neighborhoods are getting treated first and everything like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, anybody paying attention to even CNN was covering it. Take Staten Island, for example.
Right,
Staten Island was hit really, really badly, and the Red Cross didn't show up till yesterday, you know.
Now, they didn't show up at all? Like,
not
they weren't
all.
There at all.
Not
Holy
at all.
Shit.
Not at all. The problem is when they did show up yesterday and set up a site, you know, but all of Staten Island still has no power or internet or phone. Most people don't even know that they're there, you know.
Uh-huh.
So what I've been hearing from people, friends of mine who live in Staten Island, who, you know, some of whom have lost quite a bit, some of whom were lucky. And, you know, some people are still looking for missing neighbors and family members and things like that. But they said they haven't really seen too much, you know, of exploratory missions.
Right, right. Yeah, people aren't,
So, like, they're all set up, the Red Cross is set up this great spot, but a lot of people don't know that's there. And some parts of the city, like parts of the Bronx that were hit hard and along, you know, along in Queens near, let's say, the Rockaways, where my aunt and uncle, not by blood, but by you know, family friends, live. Their whole neighborhood is decimated, and we still haven't been able to find out where they are, you know.
Wow.
There's a lot of stories like that. But even the people in the Rockaways, they're short on food, they're short on everything, and, you know, the people in the outer boroughs and, like in the Rockaways, let's say, where there are housing communities, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the projects, not a lot of quick response, but lower Manhattan, where, you know, you've got, like, the financial centers and some of the morgues, but, you know, they've got water stations all over lower Manhattan and stuff like that. So there's been a lot of sort of anger from the poorer communities saying that the response has been slow.
Yeah, that's a man that and God, you know, and we all kind of when this hurricane was bearing down on you guys, you know, the rest of the country was kind of making a big joke about it. And you know, and I was definitely one of those people on Twitter that was, you know, making Hurricane Sandy jokes and everything like that.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
and then, you know, 2 days later, we're starting to see, you know, a lot of the aftermath and seeing these pictures and hearing these stories about people being swept away. And I cannot help but feel like a total asshole, you know, I mean,
you know, we were getting phone calls from a lot of our friends around the country that initially had the same impression, like, oh, well, it wasn't really that bad. Right. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I mean, like let's take, for example, my class size at my gym.
Right, right.
Like the average class size is 15 people in a class. We reopened Thursday. We had 2 people showed up and yesterday, Friday, we had 1 person show up.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's, the city is sort of in, like I said before, it's in this weird state. There are sections of the city that it feels sort of normal, but most of the city it's not.
Right, right. Well, and getting from place to place is nearly impossible right now.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, not to mention that in some areas of, you know, there's all the negative stuff going on that the media doesn't talk about, like the looting and the robberies and burglaries. And I mean, I've heard stories of friends that live in some neighborhoods that are still in the blackout that, you know, just don't go out at night, you know. And then,
right,
and then one of
right.
the one of the problems with trying to, you know, let's say the people in the areas that are really hard hit, that they shouldn't be living in these homes because they're so dangerous, they're refusing to leave because they're afraid of looting and stuff like that.
Right,
yeah.
Man, that's insane.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's really
crazy. I can't even imagine going through something like that. But we do want to urge people to go to redcross.org, make a donation. You know, stay away from any, you know, other kind of, I don't know how you say it, smaller, like charitable things, you know, like what happened with Haiti. Stay away from that kind of stuff. Don't donate to the rappers of the world.
Yeah, just meet the Red Cross or even the New York chapter of the Red Cross. They have an interactive map, you know, of how you can help. So it's nyredcross.org.
Oh, cool.
And you know, it's for people who are more local who want to volunteer or
right.
They'll also tell you where to donate. You can also text donations. You know, all that information is there. So
Well, help out, everybody. Help out, because it does look like that storm was pretty serious. But Stephen, we really appreciate you coming on the show, man, and taking some time out of your anniversary day to talk with me here and share your story.
I appreciate it. I love the show. You know, it's glad to when you touch base and asked me to come on. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, of course. Well, it's nice to finally talk with you. And hang on the line just for a second because I want to get your address. We're going to send you a T-shirt and a poster.
Oh, thanks.
So hold on there, sir. Hey. We're going to go.
Aaron.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I do a quick shout out? I am drinking right now. this is a local shout out.
Okay. Of course.
Yeah, I go to Seattle, not, you know, pretty often for business.
Uh huh.
And Cafe Umbria, man, they are awesome. They are on 16th Avenue South. You know, I'm not sure what part of Seattle that is, to be honest, but I was introduced to them a few years ago, and ever since then, we order 5-pound bags of coffee from there.
Like, oh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
Those guys, I'm drinking some right now, so. And I'm sitting at my kitchen table. I know it can be at yours. So I'm sitting at mine.
Great, man. Great. Well, Cafe Umbria. Get on that. Sounds good. Stephen Kopfer drinks it. Why don't you, right?
That's it, man.
All right. Thank you, Stephen, for joining us. Hang on the line just for a second. We're going to be featuring music today by the band River Giant. This song is called Pink Flamingos. And when we return, we will have more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears with a very special guest, author and journalist, professional journalist, Charles R. Cross. So stay with us. This is River Giant with Pink Flamingos, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
If I lose him the second, oh, I'd feel alone.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to Dining Room Studios, episode 121, with our very special guest here joining me. High atop the Greenwood neighborhood here in North Seattle is Charles R. Cross, author and editor of the old rag, The Rocket, here in Seattle. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for joining me.
Are you saying that I'm old? Is that your implication? It's the defunct mag. So I'm not.
I shouldn't
old,
have
you, defunct.
See,
that's even worse.
This is what makes me nervous about having like professional writers on this show is the choice of words that I choose.
Words are power.
There you go. See. Well, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you.
You just finished a book on Anne and Nancy Wilson, a biography on the band Heart, and you've got a few books that you've done on local musicians, Jimi Hendrix and Kurt Cobain, to name a few. And you've also got one in the works, right, for Led Zeppelin?
No, that already came out.
Oh, that did come out already. Mm-hmm. Oh. I did not know that.
About 5 years ago. You're way behind that.
You need to update your website, I think, as well. Is that true?
I do need to update my website, but just because it's listed on my website. Yeah, I need to update my website. I do. You want to help me with that? I was actually thinking of doing that today. Here I am talking to you.
Hey, we can do that. We can do that. No problem. What got you into writing biographies on musicians?
Well, I've always obviously loved music. It's really my passion in my life. Mm-hmm. And as a journalist, I felt that the medium of writing newspapers and magazine articles was somewhat limiting, especially as a newspaper journalist, you're writing 500, maybe 1,000 words at the most. Even as a magazine writer, if you're lucky, you're writing 2,000 words on a subject. And I could never fit everything I had to say into those pieces. It just seemed that there was a narrative arc that I often was missing. And so on some of the characters that I most cared about and that I thought, you know, larger story wasn't being told by journalism, mm-hmm. I began to write books. And essentially, I'm a storyteller, but you can tell a long story when you have 180,000 words to tell it in. And
right.
That's a very different form than writing a newspaper article.
Now, has the web changed that at all? Because, I mean, now you can go on, you can have your own blog or something like that, or even on like a newspaper's website, like City Arts. They've got much longer form articles on the actual web page than they do in the magazine, don't they?
I'm not sure that they do.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the opposite, actually. I think the web and the instantaneous information, people reading text, people reading things on their phone, have made the long-form article start to die. I mean,
really?
it's what we call the USA Todification of newspaper journalism.
Mm-hmm.
When USA Today came around, which, you know, first made its real big impression in the 80s, the idea that you could write a short blurb and you could have albums reviewed in, you know, 75 words.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way it used to be. If you picked up a copy of Rolling Stone today, and admittedly it's way, way smaller than it used to be, and you compared that to Rolling Stone in 1976, when I first started reading it as a little kid, the size of the record reviews are just dramatically different. You literally might have had a record review that was 1,500 or 2,000 words. And now,
if
you're lucky, it's 50 words or 75 words.
Well, plus they're doing like maybe 20 of them too, right?
Correct. And
you know? And they're all smashed on that little
page.
They're
all smashed.
They've made the size of the actual magazine even smaller now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not just the fact that magazines are smaller in this world, you know, economic situation where Craigslist has taken the bite out of newspapers. But it also is that people's attention span, you know, it's short attention span theater.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody
mm-hmm.
wants to sit down with anything for a long time. They edit, they skirt, they multitask, and the profile of, you know, that used to be happen in every magazine, not just the New Yorker, is now only a few magazines writes those long term. Only a few magazine run writes. There's a word for you. only a few magazines will actually run those kind of long term profiles.
Right. Was that scary when that started to make a change? I mean,
was it scary? It's terrifying right now.
Is it?
You know, sometimes I feel like I am, you know, telegraph operator, and the telephone was invented 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I think what's scarier for our society, and, you know, not to sound like a chicken little here, but there are some implications for our democracy when we start losing the press. The power of newspapers to do anything, you know, to criticize our government has been diminished by the fact that newspapers themselves have significantly less journalists. Most mm-hmm. daily newspapers will have maybe a third the number of journalists they had 25 years ago. And so, you know, would somebody be around to break Watergate? Would a newspaper editor be able to give somebody that space? And how many newspapers are even left?
Right, right.
You know, in most cities, there were three or four 30 or 40 years ago, and now you are lucky to even have one daily newspaper. In a few markets, they don't have a daily newspaper. They have a 3-4 times a week newspaper.
Yeah.
So there are some questions about the future of this business. I mean, that's one of the reasons I write books, is that the book industry is diminished, but it's not diminished to the degree that the newspaper and magazine industry
are. Right. And people are still consuming books, too. Maybe not so much like hard copies of them, but they're still getting put out on things like e-readers and everything like
that. They are. And many people will then argue and go, oh, you know, can I get a e-book of your book? And, you know, you as a writer, you want someone to read an e-book. But there is an economic price for the e-revolution for authors. A book that costs $25, an author might make $2 if they're lucky, somewhere in that ballpark. And when an e-reader sells for $9.99 or less, the author shares proportionally less as well. So you'd have to sell a significant number more of e-books to make up for the cut in revenues. So it's a harder living to make for most people. And I do think that there are some consequences in our society. You know, are we going to have an educated workforce 20 years from now when we have kids that all they can do is text and they can't spell? And not only can't they write a paper, but if it's more than 140 characters, they're unable to actually compose a sentence.
Right, right. Yeah. If it's not on Twitter, then it's, you know, they don't know about it. Yeah, and that's it. You know, the recent hurricane that hit the East Coast, this is a great example of some of the stuff that scares me with the press is that, or with this, you know, the new media, is that there's so much misinformation going on out there. Like the pictures that were getting circulated on Twitter that weren't even real, right? That were doctored images and stuff. Like when you didn't even really need to doctor an image, people were just putting them out there just because, you know, and saying that, oh, look at this guy surfing this, you know, 120-foot wave that was coming in hitting New Jersey or something like that, you know. So,
well, we lived in a society once where we had gatekeepers. We had editors of newspapers, and maybe they were overpaid and maybe some of them were bad, but they still were people who, at least in the vast majority of the cases, tried to operate with an ethical standard.
Uh-huh.
And when everybody became a podcaster or a blogger or a Twitterer or whatever or a Yelp reviewer of my own restaurant that I own, the standards are the ethics of what is a journalist and what isn't,
right,
and what people feel like they want to say. We live in a very narcissistic me society. Now, that's coming from a writer who, by your very nature as a writer, you're sort of a, you know, you're admitting that you're somewhat of a narcissist. If you think your thoughts are important enough that you're going to write them down and share it with the world, you're clearly a victim of that. But you hope you're a professional and you hope you're good at it. And if you are, then you do have people that read your books or your articles.
One last thing on this subject that I want to talk to you about, and this is something that I wanted to save for the end of the show. But since we're in it, we might as well just broach the subject right now, is that you mentioned that, you know, there's all these new mediums, podcasting, blogging, everything. Do you think it's oversaturated?
Absolutely. I mean, having new mediums certainly does not make the discourse more intelligent.
Right.
And when the quality of the actual writing itself has been so greatly diminished by having an uneducated or unskilled people writing reviews on Amazon.com as opposed to writing books.
Right.
You know, I think it has. I think it's been lessened.
Yeah. Yeah. Now tell me, like, cause you do a lot of music stuff for City Arts Magazine here in Seattle.
I don't actually. I've only written for them the one article you're referring to.
The Rainwolf one?
Correct. Boy, I've written one or two things.
Here's an example of...
There you go. You get these internet
the podcast fly by night.
Don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, no kidding, man.
And I didn't need to interrupt you, but I generally try to be very accurate. So I've written three or four things for them over the last 10 years, but I don't write for them a lot.
Okay. So it's more of a freelance thing.
Correct. I'm not on the staff there.
Okay. Well, I apologize for getting that wrong there. But
and you got the date of the Zeppelin book wrong as
well. Yeah, totally. Wow. You know? See, it's very loose, though. It's very loose. This is just a conversation between two people. So there seems to be a lot of, like, you know, music review, music podcasts like mine. And I don't have any delusions of grandeur here. You know, this is a show purely for entertainment, and purely to sow my own oats, so to speak, because I am a narcissistic person. You have to be one to talk about yourself for an hour every week, you know. But there is a bit of, I notice myself, even being part of this, there is a whole lot of oversaturation in, like, the music review market, right, here in Seattle. And as a writer, as somebody who has done this professionally, you know, does that irk you at all? Like, I mean, does that, when all this stuff kind of started coming around, does it, you know, pull at your strings a little bit?
I guess, but if it irks me, that, how does that change my existence? Pigeons irk me as well. And, you know, as do rats and other sort of vermin. Certainly there are, one of the standards that I think shifted with the idea of being a music critic, and it shifted about the advent of the internet and certainly with the advent of Amazon.com, where most of the reviews of an album, if Amazon.com is running an editorial review of the new Jim Croce album, they're going to give it a positive review because they're a forum to pitch and sell. And that's been the reality of the marketplace for a while. So I think there has been a shift, and the shift is that there are so many people who are cheerleaders. And you can't be a great music critic if you're always a cheerleader. You have to be able to say, I like this and I don't like that. And a good critic not only says if they think something is inferior, they generally will cite why and give some background for it.
Right.
And that's something that you don't get as much in today's world. You get people either saying, it's great, it's great, it's great. How many times have I heard it's great? Either in a story or from somebody at a club or somebody talking up a group.
Yeah.
Now, I've certainly probably made that same mistake myself three or four times in the last couple of days, but I'm exhausted by everything being great. And there is, I think, a boosterism to the local community where just because an act is from Seattle does not mean they're great. Yes, you know, as a music writer, I want to embrace local acts and say, you know, they're, you know, fantastic that we have artists here and we want to encourage them. I'd much rather encourage a Greenwood singer-songwriter than I would one from Amherst, Massachusetts. Why? I don't know. But just like my, you know, grass-fed beef, which I don't eat, or my locally raised vegetables, it makes me feel better to eat the kale that's raised in Green Lake than it does the kale that was raised in Idaho.
Yeah.
But is it truly better? Sometimes it is. I think the Seattle music scene has had a number of really high-quality acts over the last 50 years. And I think we have something to be proud of. We almost always have produced musicians who are left of center, who focus on songwriting, who are individual and passionate voices. That's true of the bulk of them. But have there been some boners and losers amid the bunch? And in the current crop that many people are big boosters of, yes, there still are. And I think one of the problems being a music critic now who's over the age of 25, in case you didn't guess, is that one of the things I see a lot is I will see somebody today and I will go, well, Jack, I'll just pick on somebody that's a big fish and easy to pick on. Jack Johnson, okay? Mm-hmm. There's not a music critic in America who, you know, wrote a piece this morning about how great Jack Johnson is. He's not bad. I think he's a sweet guy, according mm-hmm. to everything I know about him. But when I listen to Jack Johnson, I hear 20 other acts that were there before Jack Johnson that were around in the 70s that did singer-songwriter material, who, in my opinion, did almost exactly the same thing, maybe with a slight different shading. And I think that's what's happening more and more. I'm a big supporter of KEXP. I love a lot of the bands on KEXP. I use the euphemism we used. A lot of them are great. But they're also, unfortunately, within alternative rock, there are a lot of acts that haven't really developed enough of their own unique voice. They don't necessarily have a story in what they tell that is unique from something that somebody else has told.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And I think, there is a lot of that going on. I mean, you saw the same thing happen back in the 90s, too, when, record labels were coming into town and just signing, you know, band after band after band because they were from Seattle. I mean, that's not happening right now, I don't think, not so much, but definitely a lot of fandom being created in this
scene
right
now. I think
now,
to some degree, there still is some of that happening, because being from Seattle, especially if you have a beard and you wear a long fleece coat from Goodwill, you have a certain cachet that maybe you're the next Fleet Foxes, or maybe you're the next Head in the Heart, or maybe you're the next Macklemore. And so, you know, people want a piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle music tends to go in waves. And right now we're in a pretty good wave. But for every Macklemore, we have 20 other bands that aren't as original.
Mm-hmm.
For every Head in the Heart, we have a bunch of folkies who don't quite have the harmonies. I would even argue the Head in the Heart, a great band. I really like them. I just used the word great that I promised I would never use again. But
it's a podcast, Charles.
Yeah,
they don't have
an edge that is... You know, is the Head in the Heart better than Crosby, Stills, and Nash? I don't know. They're not. Not in my mind.
No.
But we'll see. Their career is still young.
Yeah. They're still touring off their first album.
They are. The one thing that's missing so much is a focus on songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not who you know in the music industry. It's not the break you get. It's not the big show. It's if you write a great song, it'll rise above. Whether you cover it or someone else covers it. And the people that we know in Seattle and that we love and that we think of Seattle's all-time classics, whether that's Alice in Chains or Nirvana or Soundgarden or the Sonics or Heart or Jimi Hendrix, they all wrote great songs. And that word is appropriate in that context.
Yeah,
they wrote...
Because it has staying power, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's what is lacking with many young bands. Of course, as I say that... There are probably young listeners who go, that's an old fart. And I really like, I love my, I don't want to necessarily name a band. I mean, I'll name Alan Stone, for example.
Right.
There are people who adore him. I think he's got a great voice. He hasn't written a great song, in my opinion, as a music critic. Some people might argue with that. Alan Stone probably would argue with that.
Yeah.
But I've seen Al Green. I've seen, some great soul singers in my time. And I keep using the word great. Once you sort of say it, it's like picking a scab, you can't stop.
It's like a worm. It's just bored itself into your head.
But Alan Stone, not to quote from a debate, is no Marvin Gaye.
Yeah.
But, you know, how many Marvin Gayes can there be? Is there a place for a good soul singer from Seattle? Yeah, I think there is.
Yeah.
But write a slightly better song, in my opinion, and then I'll be standing in the front embracing it.
Right on, man. Well, hey, this is a great spot to go to our second musical break. We're featuring music by the band River Giant today. This song is called Western, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest Charles R. Cross here today. We'll be right back. Sailblades drop south grid, land eels, come cold rock in the rail pits, cold ideals, cold life coming, night falls eyes, forlorn and trying, world bright. We were back. That was Western by the band River Giants off of their current album out right now. Self-titled, River Giant. Go get it. Rivergiant.org. And joining us here today is author, Mr. Charles R. Cross. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks.
And when we left, we were talking about kind of the scene of Seattle today. And what it looks like, you know, there's some oversaturation, a lot of fandom going on for things that aren't necessarily the best. Would you say?
Well,
or they're not great. They don't have some of this stuff does not have staying power. But I do want to move on.
It's probably
from that.
True to say that in every era there was a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah,
staying
yeah,
power.
Totally.
But
totally. I mean, look at Fat Mattress. You know?
Exactly. Fat Mattress did not have staying power.
No,
if anybody doesn't know, Fat Mattress was Noel Redding, who was the bass player in the Jimi Hendrix Experience. This was going to be the breakthrough that he left the Jimi Hendrix Experience for.
Exactly.
So,
have that album on vinyl, of course. I doubt it's on CD or anything like that.
There's a reissue for Light in the Attic to get in on and, get all over.
I did want to switch gears just a little bit here, Charles, and talk to you about how you got into writing
in this high paying profession.
Yeah, in this this lucrative profession you call being an author.
Well, I don't know that you get into writing. You either, I don't want to say you're born a writer or not, but it just is something nobody, if they're smart. Right now in college is going, you know what I'm going to be? You know what my pot of gold is going to be? I'm going to get into writing. There was a time when that was considered you could be a journeyman writer.
Mm-hmm.
You could write like, you know, Raymond Chandler, Pulp Fiction or something. There was a time where that sort of happened more. And, it doesn't now, but, I don't know that I picked the smartest profession, but it's what picked me. It's less that I picked it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I mean, obviously you went to college for this, correct?
Actually, I did go to college, but I'm going to disagree with the way you said that.
Oh, yeah?
Because that's a pet point of mine, which is to make the assumption initially, obviously you went to college. I feel that writing can't be taught, and I still feel there's so many people I meet that are young writers or people that want to be writers, and they go, I need to go to college to learn to write. And I argue that you learn to write by writing or by reading,
uh-huh.
That I'm not sure that a professor standing up at a chalkboard can truly teach you how to have a voice. The key to writing is a voice. And certainly there are good writing teachers, and I don't mean to disparage the entire profession. And I did go to the UW and I had a couple excellent writing teachers,
uh-huh.
but they were actually English literature teachers. They were not journalism teachers. I took a few journalism classes and I I learned the inverted pyramid, which I rejected outright at that point. That was an era where journalists were taught to not have their own voice, to not have themselves in an article, and to only focus on the who, what, why, where, how, and to leave everything else out. And I was constantly railing against the journalism department, though it does irk me that occasionally the UW journalism department will try to claim me as a graduate or a proud member when I was not. So I did go to college. I did learn how to write in college to some degree, but that was from working at my school newspaper far more than anything I learned in a class.
Yeah. So what did you write when you were younger, before college?
I wrote for my high school newspaper.
Okay, okay. And did you enjoy like writing poetry at that
point? Yeah, I wrote poetry and songs and all the typical crap a 16-year-old boy whose heart is broken by Sarah Henson of Pullman, Washington. You know, that's the kind of crap I wrote.
Right.
So
I guess everybody kind of writes that kind of stuff, though.
They pretty much do. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So when did you know?
I still do. That's pretty much mostly what I write. I just don't publish it.
That's private. That's private stuff. That's your private stash. So when did you realize that this was going to be the thing that you did for a living?
I haven't realized that yet. Have you? Am I supposed to realize that at some point?
I guess so, right? That's what's that's part of.
Yeah, I don't know that you ever realize it. I mean, in the course of, you know, I haven't had a day job for a couple decades, but I still do stuff occasionally where afterwards I go, I did that for money. You know, I will do, even in my profession now, copywriting, sometimes helping people with a variety of projects, writing almost like technical writing, but mostly I write books, and I have managed to make a living at that, and I'm grateful for that. But I don't know that there ever was a point where I said, okay, I'm abandoning XYZ to do that. Though that's not completely fair. There was a point where I had an actual job. I was working for Cornish Institute, the Cornish College of the Arts, and I was their PR person. That was one of my last jobs. And there was a point where I chucked that to work for the Rocket, and I left a real job with benefits and sort of a halfway salary working for an arts college to work for the Rocket for $200 a month, no benefits, no nothing.
Right. And the Rocket, for people who don't know, was the free kind of weekly magazine.
Well, it wasn't weekly. It was monthly.
It wasn't weekly?
It was monthly for its first 15 years, and for its last 10 years, it was bi-weekly every other week.
Oh, okay. So completely wrong
weekly.
Again. See? Podcast. Doesn't matter. No, I have no journalistic integrity.
Clearly
whatsoever.
Not.
But
neither did anybody that worked at the Rocket.
Well, the Rocket kind of morphed into the Stranger, right?
It did not. It had absolutely nothing to do with the Stranger.
Nothing to do with the Stranger. Not even the same people went to work at the Stranger.
I mean, there were one or two people over the years that had worked at the Rocket that worked at the Stranger, but there's no connection.
Okay. And what was that experience like then? Working for that monthly magazine.
Well, it was very exciting. It was a time when the Seattle music scene was exploding. At least the late 80s were. The mid 80s were less enjoyable time. And it was very exciting, and lots of late night pizza and very little sleep, and lots of maniac creative people that I worked with. Sometimes they did brilliant things and sometimes they did jackass things. So yeah. You know, it was like anything in life. It was both very rewarding and at times very frustrating and tedious. In retrospect, everyone looks back on it now and go, boy, the Rocket in 1991 when Nirvana was coming out, that must have been extremely exciting place to be. And that's all the halcyon look back of going, you know, but I'm obviously, as you can tell, somewhat of a stickler for accuracy or seeing things portrayed as they were.
Right, right.
And, you know, Nirvana was not a great live band at every show they did. There were times they played that they were horrible. Uh-huh. Maybe it was one-third of their concerts were horrible and two-thirds were great. It depends on the sound system and Cobain's personality at any given point. Just because you were seeing Tad or Mudhoney or Soundgarden or Nirvana didn't mean it was the second coming, because it always didn't always feel like that.
Right, right.
So that's true of that era. There were times where it was very exciting, and there were times where it was extremely boring. And
It was work. Yeah. Yeah, definitely the 90s in Seattle is definitely glorified, right? But I mean, that happens every time you look back on something.
Yeah,
right?
So is the 1880s and the 1920s. But because within music, we have yet to see a time since that was the same as the early 90s in Seattle. In 1994, we had five bands from Seattle debut at number one in the Billboard charts. That little run-up of that, that chart dominance and also critical dominance, those two things together, you had really talented bands who were also selling a buttload of records. That has not happened to a town since 1994 in Seattle. There have been other music scenes that have developed. There are certainly big artists. There are people, Taylor Swift has sold a lot of records, but there hasn't been sort of the same thing happen where one town was so on fire.
Right.
And that's one reason we look back on it and we think of it as, you know, one of the last great vestiges of a very active and vibrant music scene.
Yeah, yeah. Now, to switch gears one more time here, it says here in your bio that you collect pinball machines.
Are you reading that from my website?
Yeah.
See, that's why my website needs to be updated. And you can't believe everything you read on the web or on Wikipedia or... So, I have collected pinball machines
in
my course of my life. I don't have any right now.
Oh man.
But I know quite a bit about pinball machines. I've written a few articles on them on my living room wall. A back glass of the KISS pinball machine hangs right now.
Oh,
so,
nice.
But I don't own any presently. And part of it was that the last time I moved, I just about broke my back.
Oh, I bet.
Moving them. So
yeah. Yeah. Were you a big fan of like the ones from the 70s or,
absolutely,
or newer?
The 70s and 60s, anything after that point stunk.
Just garbage.
Just pretty much garbage.
All right. Well, that's a great place to end it. Charles R. Cross, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
What's the new book?
My latest book is the biography of Anne and Nancy Wilson called Kicking and Dreaming, a story of heart, soul, and rock and roll.
Awesome. And you can find that at anywhere books are sold and possibly not on your website, which
you
is
can find it. You actually can't find it on my website. There's no mention of it, but I may update it in an next half hour. So
yeah, yeah, we'll work on that together. Yeah. We'll work on to that together. And luckily, you'll be here so I can have my facts straight. Well, thanks again for joining me here, sir. And we're going to go out today with the song Taylor Mountain by the band River Giant off of their self-titled debut record. And we'll be back next week with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Have a good one, everybody.